The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. Unfortunately, the news from Israel-Palestine continues to dominate the news. A war that some of us had expected would have been very brief has continued for more than half a year. There's no end in sight, and it's having global repercussions, some of which we're seeing in the United States right now as protests spread across campuses and are being met with almost unprecedented level of repression, certainly in recent decades. I think maybe if one goes back to the period of the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement, there were comparable pushbacks from university administration and the police. But what we're seeing now in Columbia University and UCLA and many other campuses, the police presence, the police crackdown, the level of police violence is you know, it's not something that Americans have seen in recent decades. And it almost goes against all the sort of protocols for de-escalation that university administrations adopted in the 1970s in response to the previous decade's wave of protest. It's a very dangerous situation and one that is has implications not just for Israel-Palestine, but for American politics more broadly, as this issue becomes a lightning rod of controversy and is starting to shatter the coalition that Joe Biden needs to have in place if he wants to win re-election. To talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on a guest who's been on before, Youssef Munier. He's a Palestinian-American writer, very thoughtful. And I just, I mean, to sort of like just jump into this, Youssef, what's your response to the protests that we've been seeing?
Yeah, well, thank you, G. It's good to chat with you about this, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on. You know, I think what we're seeing is nothing short of remarkable. The scale, the scope of what's taking place. You know, on the one hand, you know, we can say, why did it take so long? You know, this war on Gaza has been going on for months. But, you know, at the same time, you know, seeing how widespread this is, seeing how many students are involved, seeing how diverse the groups of students that are involved in these protests are, seeing the extent to which these student protesters are willing to sacrifice. I mean, we've seen something like, you know, over 2,000 arrests so far as of this time, right? There are students who are being suspended, some being expelled from school, being evicted from their housing. You know, that is a scale of sacrifice that I think is really significant and just underscores how much people care about this issue and are willing to sort of pay a price to try to finally create some change here. And, you know, on the one hand, yes, I mean, it's been a horrific 7 months. But I think, you know, one thing that if you speak to many of these protesters, you'll understand. I think if you speak to many Palestinians, you'll understand. It's been 7 months and 75 years. This is a horrific episode in a much longer history of Palestinian dispossession, occupation, apartheid, and so on. And, you know, we have over the years moved in a direction of growing outrage over what people are seeing. And of course, the last 7 months have been a tremendous catalyst in that movement. And for so many of these younger folks, they've seen enough. You know, they want change. They want serious change. And they're willing to make some sacrifices to make that happen because they don't feel that their voices, that their views, their concerns are being represented by the policymakers who are shaping policy around this issue. And I think, you know, when you see, you know, over 37,000 Palestinians who've been killed over the last 7 months in the Gaza Strip, the scale of destruction. And then you see alongside that an American government which is rushing to send even greater unprecedented amounts of weapons to Israel despite that. People are outraged. They're absolutely outraged. And that I think explains a lot of what we're seeing now.
I think that's right. And I think for anyone who's been involved with this issue or has followed this issue over the last few decades, what's happened in the last 7 months has really been remarkable, because at some point I did expect that the American public would start shifting on this issue. But I did not expect things to start happening so quickly and for mobilization to happen so quickly and to see the kind of protests that we're having happen. And it's perhaps a testament to the sort of, you know, unsung work that's been going on for decades of, you know, building the coalition, making the arguments, winning recruits, and, you know, having everything in place for when this crisis happened. There's a lot of planning and a lot of organizing and a lot of sheer sort of intellectual and political work that has gone into this. We've also seen, though, a sort of, you know, counter response, which I think is also in some ways equally remarkable, because what the university administrations are doing, what most bipartisan politicians are doing, the Democrats and Republicans, is a kind of level of repression that sort of gives lie to many of their own stated values. You know, anyone who's spent time in academia knows, like, all the kind of lip service that's paid to free speech, to open discourse, listening to students, safety for students. And like, that's all gone out the window very quickly. And especially, like, in certain places, like Columbia, Cornell, they actually, like, part of their identity as universities was how they can handle activism. That, you know, if you go to Cornell, you will be taught very early on about the 1969 Black Power uprising and how the university mishandled that and the lessons learned and how Cornell is now, you know, a place for activists. And the same is true of Columbia for the 1968 anti-war uprising. And suddenly, like, you know, like, all that talk, all that one could say branding, they're willing to throw that away for what? And the same, I think, applies to the political elites. I mean, Joe Biden is very seriously undermining his own political coalition, the coalition that brought him in. And one can compare his response to the Black Lives Matter uprising of 2020, where he said, you know, made a careful distinction to say, you know, I don't approve of property damage, but this is a free speech issue, this is a civil rights issue, and people have the right to go on and protest. And to compare his words to now. So I guess my question is, like, why are the sort of, you know, centrist political elites willing to endanger, you know, their own status and their own institutions, the legitimacy of their own institutions and their own positions in society, in order to keep supporting this war in Gaza and the unchecked settler violence in the West Bank?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing when it comes to Biden and some of the things that he said recently and the speech that he gave from the White House. He said, you know, in America, dissent can never lead to disorder. And, you know, he said this from the White House. And I guarantee you that somewhere in that building, there is a portrait of the Boston Tea Party. Which is a moment where dissent leads to disorder and launches an American revolution. And if it wasn't for that, frankly, you know, it would still be the King of England delivering those remarks. Disorder, you know, as a product of dissent is how so much social transformation has happened in America. So he obviously presented a very sort of revisionist history there. As you noted, it was a line that differs from the very message that he was sending as a candidate in 2020 when he was responding to the George Floyd protests that were sweeping the nation at the time. I think something is broken in and around this issue. And I think it's a consensus. And I see this as a process that is evolving in stages over time. There was a stage where persuasion was possible. There was effectively a consensus, a hegemonic consensus around U.S. support for Israel. And people were convinced without a lot of effort that that was the right position for the United States, whether it's because you believed it served U.S. interests or because you believed that Israel was a democracy or what have you. That started to shift. And as that started to shift, and of course, we see that shift in a more pronounced way among particular demographics and in a partisan fashion. As that shift started to happen, we saw that persuasion was no longer effective. And so we began to see a lot more intimidation. And you see that with the role that interest groups play in trying to police the discourse and trying to impose costs on any policymakers who might try to speak up for the rights of Palestinians. And that stopped being effective as well. And after that, you get coercion. And you start seeing all of these different attempts to pass legislation, making it illegal to boycott Israel, or attempts to install into law definitions of anti-Semitism that would create speech codes around what you could say about Israel. That became insufficient too. And now we are starting to see quite violent repression, mm-hmm. right? And that seems to be foreshadowing the future of this confrontation, that it is increasingly going to take the batons of police to uphold this consensus around U.S. support for Israel, which itself has a limited ceiling. At some point that breaks. At some point that's no longer tenable. And I think the quickness with which we've reached that point has surprised a lot of us. And I think a lot of that has to do with the horrific nature of what we've seen over the last several months. And it's hard to tell where we go from here. If this is something that continues to snowball. But it seems like the cat's out of the bag at this point. And many of these students have crossed a fear barrier. You know, there was a time where some of these, you know, efforts by a number of Zionist organizations aimed to smear the reputations of students by, you know, putting their faces up on a website, things like Canary Mission. You might be familiar with this. Yeah. And the idea is, you know, you tarnish the reputation of these student activists. It makes it harder for them to get jobs. And this sort of deters them from being involved in activism. Well, now you've got students willing to risk arrest, willing to risk expulsion, willing to risk suspension. That's a fear barrier that's been broken. And I think that suggests that the future is going to be a much more contentious one around this issue. And it's going to require more violent repression to try to keep this consensus around. And of course, because this consensus is sold and framed as support for a like-minded democracy, right? The use of violent repression to maintain that just doesn't compute, right? It just doesn't fit. And so at some point there become diminishing returns to that violent repression, and there is more and more mobilization that happens because of it, right?
That's what's striking to me, because I think it was like pretty predictable that like if you brought in the cuffs to like Colombia as they did, this thing was just going to spread. More schools would have encampments. I could have like told them that if they, you know, had asked me for my advice on this, like, you know, like, you're not serving your own best interest here, guys. It's amazing to me that they don't have any conception. That this repression not only doesn't work, it's like completely counterproductive. I mean, I assume at some point there'll be some limit to how much the protest can spread, but like certainly they're doing like a wonderful job of like advertising it and making it, and it's actually spread like transnationally, like it's in, you know, Mexico and Canada and
all over the world.
I expect it's going to be everywhere. As you say, it's hard to know like where this is exactly going, except I have to think that there are people, I know this, that there are people, you know, within the system, within the party, within the political elite, almost on a bipartisan basis, that like have real doubts about where we're going, where we're seeing very respectable establishment people from, you know, places like the Council on Foreign Relations, saying like, you know, like there's the cost of our alliance with Israel is getting out of hand. And if the cost is domestic as well as international, if Israel is a domestic issue, if Joe Biden has succeeded in actually like bringing, the repressive authoritarian values of Benjamin Netanyahu to the United States, then the actual cost of the alliance like are way up, because you're not just like, you know, making people all over the world angry. You're not only undermining America's reputation on human rights, but you're actually like harming your own ability to like reproduce the elite, to like actually like, you know, be able to groom and co-opt a next generation that will replace you. But like it just seems like do you think like at some point people within the elite are going to do like a cost, just a basic cost benefit analysis, and say like, you know, this is not worth it anymore?
Yeah, I think at some point we arrive at that juncture, you know, and we're heading there. It's a question of when, right? And I think what we realize from this protest is that we're much closer than we thought to that point. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Some of these universities, as you point out, you know, have handled this so terribly. Some of them have been more willing to invite an occupation onto their own campuses before they divest from an occupation that's happening thousands of miles away. And they don't see a problem with this. And yet, you know, we also should know that there are some universities who have handled this much, much better. They have engaged with the students. They have listened to their demands. They have found a way to move forward with dialogue. And you look at Brown University, for example, Evergreen University, they've handled this completely differently, and they don't end up with the violent and disgusting circus that we see in places like Columbia and UCLA. So there are, of course, better ways of doing this. One thing we see in the history of contentious politics is it's rare that singular moments lead to transformational change. But it's contentious politics that comes in waves over time that ultimately leads to transformational change. And I think, you know, this semester is going to end. At some point, these protests are going to die down. But this issue is not going away on campus. And you're going to see repeated demands from students to get their universities to divest. And I think, you know, when it comes to the Democratic Party, one thing we should keep in mind is that Joe Biden's a dinosaur. I mean, he is, he's running for re-election. And if he serves a full term, he's going to be 86 years old at the end of it, right? He hasn't been on a college campus, you know, in 60 years. So he's quite removed from where these students are, and he's quite removed from where the party is, especially on this issue. And I do think, you know, at some point he's not going to be at the head of the Democratic Party, whether it's, you know, after this election or after the election after that. There's going to be a shift, and it's going to have to be a calculation that puts together a coalition that's going to have to include this issue and these voices in ways that Biden wasn't willing to do or hasn't proved that he's willing to do yet. And I do think that his approach may very well cost him the election in November. And, you know, you look at the numbers, I don't know where the confidence comes from. You know, if you're in the Biden campaign and you are trying to map out a victory, there are pathways, but none of them are easy. And you're not really in a position right now where you can bleed support, especially in some of these battleground states, you know? So I think this is first of all, morally, it's such a tragic set of decisions that he's made. When it comes to the American national interest, it's horrible. But also domestically, it doesn't make sense, the position that they're taking. I mean, this is the future, you know, this is the future. And they are right now, neglecting these people, neglecting these constituents. And one thing that I think is important about the youth vote, you know, we look at these poll numbers all the time. It's not just about winning the youth vote. It's about getting the constituencies that you win to have the enthusiasm to turn out at the numbers that you need. And that doesn't always get captured in polls at all. You can win 90% of the black vote, 60% of the women, 70% of the youth. But if they don't turn out at the numbers that they need because they can't bring themselves to make that decision because of everything that they've seen, this administration support, it's not going to help. And I think this is the very big piece that they're missing.
Yeah, no. I looking at the polls, it's hard to disagree with you. Like in all the swing states, it's either, you know, very close or Trump has a healthy lead. And in certain places, like, you know, you think about Wisconsin, like if Democrats do not get like a huge turnout in sort of the Madison area, you know, where the campus community, they can't win that state. But that's just a fact. And so I actually think, you know, like if I were running for president, and I needed to win the campus vote on a swing state, I would not be sending in cops to beat up students and professors.
Absolutely not. In so many of these states, right? In so many of these states, the swing states in particular, right? The localities where you have these universities, those are the votes that Democrats rely on to be able to win those states, especially with narrow margins, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's just... Anyways, it's remarkable. Leaving aside the politics of it, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the national security, because I don't think this gets emphasized enough in discussions. Like, to me, there's no strategic rationale for the United States to be supporting what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank. Like, it seems like a huge kind of liability for the United States. And, you know, I think increasingly one is seeing Biden's foreign policy is in shambles. I mean, the whole rationale for a lot of this, the bear hug strategy, was the Abraham Accords. Abraham, you know, like, we'll keep close with Israel, give them what they want, and then be able to get them and Saudi Arabia into a security agreement. Well, it looks like that's not going to happen. And now they're talking about doing an agreement with Saudi Arabia without recognition of the Palestinians and without normalization of Israel. So if that's what they're heading towards, like, why are they doing any of this? Like, what is the strategic rationale? Like, am I missing something? Is there any logic to their position?
I think one of the biggest mistakes that Biden made after October 7th was that he kept his national security staff in the same exact place. Mm-hmm. They completely misread the region. And it was those same folks who completely misread the region that were now going to be navigating the single biggest crisis in the region in decades. And so we shouldn't be surprised that they end up in a place like this. You know, they chose a bear hug strategy with the Israelis, except it didn't work, right? They weren't able to modify Israeli behavior. The single time that the United States was able to effectively modify Israeli behavior was not when they were praising them or echoing their narrative, but was when Biden picked up the damn phone and told the Israelis, either you do this or else. And suddenly, amazingly, right, we started to see, oh, the crossings are now open and we're going to commit to letting humanitarian aid in and all this kind of stuff. Months they were asking for that. It didn't happen. With one phone call, it shifted, right? That approach, Biden was advised to take that approach. Maybe it was also his instinct. But the fact that he had folks around him who were not pushing for a different approach, even though they were all watching it fail, I think is you know, a big part of what went wrong here. And now you're in a place, like you said, they've invested all this time and effort in trying to get some, you know, fantastic deal that they're going to try to make with Saudi Arabia and ignore the fact that the whole damn region is on fire and try to somehow walk away from all of this with a transformational Saudi-Israeli normalization agreement. I mean, that was not easy in good times, right? And now they're trying to, like, it just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense that they think that this is going to work. And I also think they're not just misreading the region in terms of sort of the broader Arab and Muslim world. They've also really misread the Israeli government, and they've really misread Benjamin Netanyahu. They believed, I think very wrongly, that Netanyahu cares about these normalization agreements more than anything else. He doesn't. That's not the case. He cares first and foremost about staying in power in Israel. And to the extent that he cares about these normalization agreements, it's to prevent the emergence of a Palestinian state. It's to prevent Israeli-Palestinian peace and to keep the onus off of Israel for peacemaking. And, you know, when push came to shove and he has clearly been presented with an opportunity to normalize relations with Saudi Arabia, he can't even talk about creating a pathway for a Palestinian state, right? I mean, they're giving him an opportunity to slow walk this process to death again, as they did with the Camp David Accords, as they did with the Oslo process. He can't even sign up for that, you know? And I think they've really misread Netanyahu, and it's one of the reasons why they find themselves where they are.
Well, yeah, no, it's hard to disagree with that as well. And it's a bit puzzling because, like, how much more, like, evidence do you need? Because Netanyahu's pattern, it's not like he hides who he is. And his pattern of behavior has been very clear. And his whole political identity, going back at least to the 1990s, has been like, I am the guy who will stop a Palestinian state. That is his selling point to the Israeli public. So,
and he keeps saying it over and over.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And now, you know, with the ongoing negotiations with, like, Hamas, I mean, he has basically, like, said he will any ceasefire will not be permanent. So basically, you know, saying that he will continue the war no matter what. How can the Biden administration think that this is, like, A, in the national security interest of the United States, or B, in the interest of Joe Biden himself to be reelected as president? Because the longer Gaza stays in the news, the longer there's global turmoil because of Gaza, like, the harder it is to make the case for Biden's reelection. Am I missing something? Like, what is he not?
Look, you know, the Secretary of State just spent so much time in the region going from place to place, trying to negotiate this deal, trying to get it done and so on. And he goes to Israel. And while he's in Israel, Netanyahu comes out and says, well, we're gonna do this invasion of Rafah, whether we have this deal or we don't have this deal, right? And I mean, obviously, these negotiations are in an incredibly sensitive juncture, right? You've got delegations going from country to country, things that have been painstakingly mapped out by different mediators, and you're in this very sensitive moment. And while the Secretary of State is visiting Israel, Netanyahu comes out and says, oh, we're going to do it anyway, whether we get it. I mean, you know, this kind of language can only be seen as aimed at torpedoing this kind of agreement, the very agreement that the Secretary of State of the United States has just been running around the whole damn region trying to, you know, get finalized. And when reporters asked the Secretary of State about Netanyahu's comments, he was forced to say, well, people say all kinds of things. You know, you don't have to put a lot of credit in the things that get said. I mean, this is where we're at right now, right? And you know, they, for some reason, refuse to understand that Netanyahu is the epitome of a bad faith actor. And they keep playing ball with him. And, you know, a previous American president in interacting with Netanyahu, James Baker once kicked him out of the State Department and said, I don't want to see him back here. He's persona non grata, right? He was so fed up with Netanyahu. But Clinton said, you know, who does this guy think the superpower is here, right? And this is the sort of attitude that he's had. And, you know, an unfortunate reality is that there are domestic constraints here in the United States around this issue that in this bilateral relationship actually provide a tremendous amount of leverage to the Israelis that allow them to punch far above their weight. You know, and that is something that American presidents have too often had to take into consideration. And I think in an election year, it is a key variable in the mind of Joe Biden, especially because Biden is sort of an older school Democrat. And is not quite in tune with where the base is on this issue.
Okay, obviously the, you know, the domestic lobbying of the Israel lobby is a huge kind of factor. But like at one point, like does that outweigh all the polling? And you know, as you mentioned earlier, presidents, like you know, there have been, despite you know the Israel lobby existing for many decades, at various junctures in history, you know, American presidents have said enough is enough, and they've said it at like a much lower threshold than we're seen in the last 7 months. I mean,
that's once, true.
You know, mentioned like Eisenhower with Suez, Reagan with Lebanon, Bush Senior with the settlements. You know, like even Obama with Gaza in 2014. Like, at what point? And in all those cases, you know, it is that Bill Clinton question, like, you know, like, who's the fucking superpower here? And it's in the interest of an American president. I would say not just like national security interest, but also like political interest to be seen as strong, to be seen as, you know, someone who can take on a foreign country and rein them in. And it's a bit puzzling to me that, like, you know, that's not part of Joe Biden's makeup. There's something there where he cannot understand that, you know, like, actually, like, if he were able to, like, rein in Netanyahu and, like, you know, like, really pick a fight and win, of course, he'll lose some of the donors. He might lose some votes. But I got to say, they're going to be in New York and Florida, neither of which are swing states in either direction. Where the political calculus... and even more so, the national security calculus to me doesn't seem to be there. Like, how much are they sacrificing, and for what?
So I think that's largely right. You know, before October, I wrote a piece where I tried to understand what Joe Biden was doing in terms of his Israel policy, because something just didn't make sense to me. You know, in September, they were fast tracking this U.S. visa waiver program, which is something that no U.S. president was willing to do for Israel, because Israel continued to discriminate against Palestinian Americans. Yet Joe Biden was doing it anyway. He was preparing to, you know, move forward and invest diplomatically in the Saudi-Israeli, you know, deal. All while Benjamin Netanyahu was tearing Israeli society apart, you know? And I couldn't understand why on earth would Joe Biden do this? A Democratic president who clearly doesn't like the direction that this prime minister is taking Israel, a prime minister who has intervened in American politics, who's clearly on the side of Republicans, and yet Joe Biden is giving him gift after gift. What gives? And my conclusion then is that the only thing that makes sense is that, as Biden says, he is a very deeply committed Zionist. This mm-hmm. is his who he is. And, you know, there is no American president that has presided over the U.S.-Israel relationship during a time when they've killed so many Palestinians. If there was a Mount Rushmore of American presidents who have Palestinian blood on their hand, there would be one face above all else, and that's Joe Biden's. And that's a stunning thing to say. But this is who he is. I truly believe that this is the X factor that explains more than anything else, because it doesn't make sense when it comes to domestic politics or the national interest. It's about what he personally believes. And that's why I think there will be significant change when he's gone. I will also say that I do think part of it is a sort of muscle memory in American politics around this issue that, you can't go against Israel. You just can't go against Israel. Bad things happen when you go against Israel, right? Especially in an election year. It's too risky and so on and so forth. And that's something that we have seen historically, you know? And so I'm sure there are voices around him who are telling him that, who are arguing that about the domestic politics. And you're right. There are states where maybe it makes a difference in terms of the vote, but they're not swing states. They're not going to change the direction of the outcome in those states themselves. The bigger issue is around political contributions. And that's where it can hurt more. But I still don't think that accounts for what we're seeing here. I don't think that accounts for enough to explain the extent of this policy.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I mean, like the sort of money explanation doesn't quite do it. There is a kind of ideological commitment. I think it might be worth roping in Biden's policies on Cuba, which are equally retrogressive and don't make a lot of political sense, because it doesn't look like Florida is anywhere near a swing state. And so in theory, Biden could, do what Obama did and normalize relations and not have to worry about losing a state that he's already going to lose. But there's something in his sort of, memory as, admittedly a man in his 80s, that he is thinking about these issues in an earlier political universe and in earlier political terms. And I think that's a tragedy. And whether he can change quickly enough, we'll see to that. But I do appreciate the optimism. And I think that you're exactly right, that the ground is shifting on this issue, and it's shifting in a positive direction. And whether it can shift fast enough to save the Democrats from their own folly, that's what we're going to spend the rest of the year finding out. Yep. So on that note, I want to thank you for this great conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me, G.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.